Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Rabbi Eli Estrin, the director of Chabad at the University of Washington here in Seattle, and a chaplain with the rank of captain in the 627th Air Base Group at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. The latter commission makes him the first active Chabad representative in the U.S. Armed Forces, and he is also connected with the University of Washington's Air Force ROTC program. Rabbi Estrin was born in Providence, Rhode Island, graduated high school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then went on to study in rabbinical seminaries in Israel, Australia, and New York City. Teaching internships took him to schools in Buffalo, New York, Sydney, Australia, where he received his rabbinical ordination in 2002, and also Simferopol, Crimea. He has been directing Chabad and other associated programs for Jewish young adults at the University of Washington since 2004. Rabbi Estrin is happily married to his wife, Kaya, and they are proud parents of five wonderful children. Rabbi Estrin, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Our goal today is to discuss some of the history and traditions of Hanukkah season within the Jewish faith, and we're planning a similar podcast on Christmas traditions in a few weeks, so stay tuned for that. However, it is not that all that often I get to interview a Jewish chaplain from Chabad who is serving in the armed forces, so I have to ask all about this because I'm very excited about this kind of stuff. Why did you take up a military commission and also work with university ROTC students?
Well, it was an interesting little, I guess, journey. When we first got here, we became very, very close to a number of students who had been either pre-military or post-military. So they were planning to go into the military or considering the military, or some who had gotten out of the military and were doing either graduate studies or whatever it was. And I quickly realized that I didn't really have the capabilities or the understanding of what they were going through in order to be able to serve them properly. I also knew that there are not that many rabbis in the military. And as a result, I always felt like this could be a way to be able to serve those people a little bit better. And serving the underserved, especially people who need it most, like in the military, giving them the encouragement, giving them the religious support that they need, was something that really, really appealed to me. But the problem was, of course, that in our culture, we do not cut our beard. So that was always something that couldn't do anything about. And every so often, I don't know how many times, but my wife and I kind of looked at each other and said, oh, this is really too bad that I can't do this because of the beard. In 2014, I believe, the DOD said that each of the branches can make their own decisions with regards to beard, you know, based on religious issues. That day, I called up a recruiting center and said, hey, I'd like to talk to you guys about this. And I got a response that is not one that you get very often in Seattle. They said, you're a rabbi? You're a gem! And I turned to my wife. I said, they had me at hello.
Oh, wow.
You don't really get that in Seattle that often. Yeah. And I thought, all right, maybe this is something that I'd like to do. I actually spoke first to National Guard, and then I have a good friend who's in the Air Force Reserve, and he said, why don't you consider Air Force Reserve? I said, well, tell me about it. Is there any difference or anything like that? And he said, well, let me introduce you to the chaplain of my unit. And I got along with him very, very well. And I thought, I could do this. And I've always enjoyed, of all branches of the military, I've always enjoyed watching what goes on with regards to the Air Force or members of the Museum of Flight and things like that. And if there's a Museum of Flight somewhere, I have a hard time not stopping there. Yeah. And so this was a natural fit. The beard thing was thankfully, has not been an issue. My commanders have been absolutely fantastic in terms of pushing it up the chain of command to be able to make sure that it's allowed in, you know, places that I go.
Yeah, we recently had a podcast with a Sikh who was lobbying for the same kind of admission into the military, that you could wear beards and things. So that law was very important there.
Yeah. Absolutely. The Sikh Coalition actually gave me a call after I enlisted. They said, all right, how did you do it? And I just said, look, this is what happened. This was the process. And they really, really appreciate it. And I know they've worked with my endorser. It's called the Elephant Institute, in order to be able to try to find commonalities and work together. But, you know, when people are committed to this country and people want to try to serve this country, and as long as it doesn't get in the way of the mission, let's do it. That's more power to them.
So I have to ask, did you have to go through basic training?
As an officer, it was a direct commission. As an officer, I go through officer training school.
Okay.
And so that's not quite as bad or as exciting, whichever way you want to look at it, as basic training. Yeah. It's 5 weeks in Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. You know, there were certainly a few weeks getting yelled at for every step you made or didn't make and that kind of thing, but it's not nearly the same.
Yeah, not a whole lot of push-ups.
No, especially not nowadays. Nowadays, they're actually not allowed to because it's considered to be demeaning.
Really? Wow. Okay, maybe I should join the military.
But then. I did complain to a UW graduate who's a Ranger and a three-time vet in Afghanistan. I sent him a text one night. I said, the drill sergeant just chewed my ear off. Do I get a Purple Heart? His response was, oh, you mean the Air Force isn't just slapping you on the back in high fives?
So. I have to ask one more thing about the Air Force, too, because there was this television series back in the 1960s called The Flying Nun, and I'm wondering now that you're commissioned in the Air Force, they're going to have a television series called The Flying Rabbi. That would be great.
Hey, I'm all for it, but in terms of the two, I think it would probably have to be more of a thriller than a comedy. And I think not just because rabbis are into fedoras and there's the connection with Michael Jackson and all that kind of thing. That's a bit of a stretch, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But nowadays, I think if you'd have a rabbi flying in the air, I think, you know, there are a lot of people out there with anti-aircraft stuff would be
true.
Trying to knock him down.
That's true. That's a good point. I was thinking jetpacks and all that kind of stuff would be kind of cool. We do want to talk about Hanukkah, but I have one more question, too, and it relates to your background in Chabad. And a lot of folks who are listening to this program might not have a firm sense of what Chabad is. So could you fill us in on what it is and how you became involved with it?
Sure. Chabad has three different meanings, and they're all intertwined. The first is a philosophy. The word Chabad is actually not a word. It's an acronym for Chachma, Bina, and Dat, and those are three intellectual processes that a person goes through as they think through a concept. And the basic philosophy is that what you study intellectually has to have an application in the real world. So concepts are not just theoretical. You have to find a way to be able to apply them. So it's a particular intellectual philosophy with a very, very practical bend, and that's lent it to an organization and a movement that is a worldwide movement, basically with the concept that not just focusing on the souls and the concepts of the souls, but realizing that when we're all connected, we need to serve each other and assist each other. So the Chabad movement has 4,000 institutions across the world. I just came back from the Chabad conference in New York City, which had, I think, 5,800 people at their dinner, the annual banquet. And that's just from the men's side. The women have a separate banquet as well so that they can focus on their particular needs and their particular struggles. Running Chabad's not just in Seattle, but in places like Kathmandu and places in middle of Africa where you would not expect a rabbi to be, but serving the Jewish community there and the tourists there and taking care of the people in that particular area of the world. And then the third element of that, of course, means a follower of the Rebbe of Chabad, the leader of Chabad, who in our generation was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who passed away in 94, who had a significant, significant impact on Jewish life across the world by inspiring us. And in terms of my own story, my wife and I owe a massive debt of gratitude to him because of the fact that he sent people to Cleveland, where both my parents are, who inspired my parents to take on a life of observance and to give them advice at times that they needed it. A very, very brilliant yet sensitive advice. That was his hallmark, was this concept of Chabad being, on one hand, very, very wise, but at the same time, extremely, extremely understanding of what's going on a day-to-day basis in people's lives. And my parents, my in-laws as well, coming from non-observant backgrounds, mm-hmm. and coming back to Judaism as a result of that. So growing up, it was something that we assisted the rabbis who lived around us, and that was something that they were role models to us, and that was something that we wanted to join, to be part of this worldwide revolution, to be able to bring a spark of Judaism to Jews wherever they were and to assist people no matter who they are, no matter where they are. And so that dedication that he showed people across cultures and no matter who they were, that's something that we try to take into our own lives.
Well, that dedication certainly is coming through, because when I wanted to do a show on the traditions of Hanukkah, I sent an email message out to my general Facebook crowd, and I said, hey, does anybody know who to talk to? And a number of my former students replied back right away, say, oh, you got to go to Rabbi Estrin. He's just the greatest. You got to get this guy here on the show. So you've made a great deal of impact at University of Washington. And so it's good to have you here talking about Hanukkah, and that's what we want to turn to next. And I'm interested in the topic, having grown up in predominantly Christian America, being a Christian myself. I knew that Hanukkah existed, but I don't really know what it is, and I think a lot of our listeners are in the same boat. So let's go ahead and talk about it, since the season is upon us now, and what better time to explore it. So let's start at the beginning. What are the origins of Hanukkah?
Okay. So for this, we're going back about 2,200 or so years ago. This is when the land of Israel was first conquered by Alexander the Great, of course, who was a Greek. As well known, he died at a pretty young age. I believe he likened himself to a shooting star or something like that, and he wanted to go out in a flame of glory, and boy, did he. And after he died, his kingdom was split into four, and one of the four ended up being what they called the Syrian Greeks at the time, run by an emperor by the name of Antiochus III. Then they were, I think, as far as I understand, they were the Seleucid family of Greeks, and they took over the region. After he died, there was an attempt to assimilate all the various cultures around into one general culture. And that approach was basically to be able to consolidate their power. Nobody had the magnetism of Alexander, who was able to allow each culture to have their own thing at the same time under his rule. And as a result, they started putting pressure on the Jews to become more Greek-like, more Hellenistic, by taking on pagan rituals, by taking on the sports and things like that that were the hallmark of the Greeks. And that was something that they had significant inroads in the Jewish community for quite a while, until Antiochus IV came out, who was known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphany, of course, is the term that he referred to himself as the Epiphany. A historian of the time referred to him as Epimenes, from the term manic, because he was a lot more of the latter than the former. And he was particularly cruel with regards to this assimilation attempt. And he began outlawing elements of Judaism, one after the other after the other. And when there was a significant amount of pushback from the Jews, he came down with an iron hand and slaughtered Jews in Jerusalem and in other places, and then just made it worse and worse and worse for the Jews. What's very interesting is that if you were a Hellenist, you were fine. That's totally, you know, you could be Jewish, but a Hellenist. But to be a religious, a traditional Jew, that was the issue. And that was really where the Maccabees came about, began in a small town in the Galilee. There was a Jewish priest by the name of Matityahu, and Matityahu was in a town called Modi'in, and a Greek general wanted them to sacrifice something to one of the Greek gods or something like that. And Matatyahu had basically had enough and killed the Greek. And there was a Jew there who was sacrificing, I think, a pig or something like that to the on this Greek altar. And, you know, he killed the Jew as well and basically said, all right, let's take up arms. He was an older man. He had five children. This was complete insanity, especially considering the strength of the Greeks. They ran off into the caves to hide because they knew that they would not be able to do this standing in their own village. And they began a guerrilla war that began, I believe, in approximately 174 before the Common Era. And this went on for a little while. As a group, they began attracting more and more people. But at the same time, the numbers were pretty low. I believe at their tops, there were 5,000 of them against armies of 40,000. The Greeks were obviously much, much more well-trained. They had been fighting wars for decades, so they understood tactics a lot better. But the Jews were quite insistent on being able to really live as free Jews. And so the importance of this whole process was that it was probably one of the first fights for religious freedom. And this went on for a while until finally the Jews, led by Judah Maccabee, the oldest son of the five, were able to retake Jerusalem in 165. And at that point, they were able to rededicate the temple. Actually, the name Hanukkah itself comes from the word Chanukat HaBayit, which means the rededication of the house, of the temple. And even though the wars themselves continued for a number of years afterwards, the celebration of Hanukkah specifically is a reference to the rededication of the temple, because that was the whole point. The land itself, obviously, from a Jewish perspective, is the Jewish land, and there was certainly the interest in being in control of the Jewish land, but that continued for many, many years afterwards. But with regards to the goal of the Maccabees was to be able to celebrate our own religion as free Jews, and so therefore the conquest of Jerusalem and the rededication of the temple was the most significant. At that point, after cleaning out the temple and you know, getting rid of all the idols and things that were there, they wanted to relight the menorah. The menorah was the candelabrum, was one of the central daily activities in the temple. It was typically lit with, I shouldn't say typically, it was lit with olive oil every single day. And they wanted to do it in the best manner possible. They did not want to go for second choices. And so therefore, they were looking for pure olive oil, not just any olive oil, pure both in the sense that we know of it, that it is not contaminated by anything, but also in terms of the spiritual idea that it wasn't contaminated by the Greeks, because the Greeks the concepts of purity and impurity really didn't speak to them. They were a very rationalistic culture, and one of their key struggles with the Jewish culture is that the Jews have an element within our culture about that's super rational, that God is not confined within nature, and the natural is just a mode of expression of God. It's not the ultimate element of God. And they were like, well, we don't understand anything past that. Can you really describe this to us? They wanted things laid out in a very logical way. And with regards to things that are beyond logic, they couldn't handle that. So the impurity was a significant thing for them. So despite the fact that the Maccabees could get any oil that they wanted, they specifically were looking for pure olive oil. They ended up finding one small cruse of oil, and that had enough oil in it to last one day. In the meantime, they needed to send people to Tekoa, which is a village in the Galilee, in order to be able to start to produce more olive oil. And that one small cruse lasted for 8 days, and that massive miracle ended up being the symbol for everything else. That you know, a small group of people are able to triumph over the great. It's a small cruse of oil that seems like it's not going to be able to last, ends up lasting the entire time. And so that's how we celebrate Hanukkah today.
I love the historical stories, and it's even more impressive when recently you get something in the news that helps to verify everything. There's been some archaeological finds in Israel related to all of this. Tell us about those.
So the biggest one, which is actually quite big, is the Greek tower that the Greeks built in Jerusalem in order to be able to house their garrison and to be able to have control of that area. Anybody who's been to Jerusalem knows that it's the top of a hill, and you have quite good views of the surrounding hills. So therefore, it's been a central spot in ancient days as well as today, but less so today because of the difference in tactics that we have nowadays. So they built this massive garrison, and I believe it's written about in the Book of Maccabees. And they had been searching for it for quite a while, and they finally located it now within the past year or two. I just actually saw today as well that they found some kind of incense holder with a duck head, which apparently is a Hellenistic cult item in the Galilee as well. And they're trying to figure out exactly where this is from. This is from the exact same period, and they're trying to figure out what these and other Greek things were doing in the area. And it obviously is part of that entire assimilation process, whether it was owned by Jews who had become Hellenistic or whether it was owned by the Greeks who came into the area. Nobody knows, but it's fascinating right now as Hanukkah is coming, these two things have been just come up. They've pulled them out of the dust.
I have to ask about this because there's all these archaeological finds coming out of Israel all the time, and you could think of a small vessel of something like that with the duck head. Yeah, you can easily lose that, but some of these things are big towers. How do you lose that?
Jerusalem is an incredible, incredible place because you have this small – it's not a big city. Mm-hmm. This small city that was destroyed – God knows how many times. And they kept on building things on top of it. And as a result, the original city was much, much lower down in the ground. And then they built more stuff and more stuff and more stuff on top of it. And now, every single time you take down a house, you have to get permits in Israel in order to be able to make sure that whatever you put back up is not on top of something else. Mm-hmm. You know, what exactly are you uncovering as you try to build something else? So the question is exactly where they need to figure it out. And you have Josephus and you have Maccabees and you have other historians who tell you about the city. But it's interesting because Seattle has a similar element of it. If you look, the history is 120 years ago. The city itself looked completely different.
Yeah.
And so to be able to figure out exactly where one thing is and exactly where something else was is a little bit difficult because of the fact that the structure of the city, the actual topography is different because of the fact that things have been taken down, things have been built up.
Yeah, I'm just so fascinated by that because, you know, we're talking large structures here. And granted, it's been 2 millennia plus, but, you know, you're building on top of a tower saying, yeah, let's build some houses here. And there's, you know, the tower just gets in the way. You just build on top of it. So
yeah, it's not 5 feet underground, the ground, though.
Yeah.
It's, you know, 15 or 20 or 30 feet under the ground.
Yeah, that's amazing how the city could be built up that way.
Exactly.
Absolutely fascinating. Another question I have about Hanukkah before we get into some of the traditions here as well is that I've noticed there are a couple different spellings for it. And I think I initially contacted you with one spelling and then you wrote back with the spelling I think that you used was C-H-A-N-U-K-A-H and I used H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H. And then I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I spelled it wrong. I committed some kind of horrible cultural
thing. No, not at
thing.
All.
So I'm just wondering, what's the difference in spellings?
I don't know how many. There could be as many as a dozen ways to spell Hanukkah because there's no ch in Hebrew. In English. There's no ch. So the question is, how do you pronounce that guttural sound? Not only how do you pronounce that guttural sound, but even in the different dialects of Hebrew, there are people who would pronounce it slightly different. So, for example, the old Sephardic pronunciation would be with a deeper back of the throat. It would be more Hanukkah. And so that's more similar to the H. I know that in many academic writings, they'll put in the KH instead of the CH. It's really potato, potato. Okay. And it really doesn't make a difference. But at the same time, it's kind of this funny thing because you could spell it any particular way. The H at the end is because the last letter in the Hebrew is an H, is a hey.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, it really doesn't make a difference.
Okay. Well, we might spell it both ways on the website to make everybody happier and find all the dozen ways of actually doing it. The next question that I have is, where does Hanukkah fit into the broad scheme of Jewish holy days or holidays? Because again, this is we're coming into Christmas season here in the United States. That's a big, huge Christian holiday, and I think a lot of growing up Christian too. I say, well, that Hanukkah is kind of like Christmas for Jews, right? That must be the thing. It must be a really major important holiday because our major important holiday is here too. Where does it fit in the big grand scheme of holy days?
It's a fascinating question. Because you'll have people who will look at the two rabbinic holidays. There's Hanukkah and Purim. Purim is typically approximately in March, where we dress up and people say, oh, it's a Jewish Halloween. But it's a separate discussion for itself. But people look at those two holidays and they say, okay, they're minor holidays. Judaism doesn't look at anything as minor. Everything has its own importance. Everything has its own perspective. And there's something uniquely beautiful about Hanukkah that is above and beyond even the biblical holidays. So with regards to the stringencies and what you need to do, the biblical holidays have much more specific religious responsibilities and such. And Hanukkah and Purim do not. But at the same time, with regards to the meaning is very, very powerful. And that meaning is exhibited by the fact that, first of all, the struggle for religious freedom is something that Jews have had as an ongoing struggle throughout the millennia after the destruction of the temple. And even to some degree before the destruction of the temple, the Romans, of course, began shutting things down. And so therefore, Jews looked at the Maccabees as people who could stand up to those who were trying to force their views. And so therefore, the holiday became more and more important within our culture because of that. It was a time that we could reflect on those concepts and that eventually we would be able to conquer over the strong, be able to serve God as we were commanded to once again. That's certainly one element. The other element is the unique one that the menorah is meant to be placed on the outside. In olden days, it was actually placed outside the door. Nowadays, it's typically placed in the window or something of the sort. But the idea is what's referred to in the rabbinic Aramaic, pirsume nisa, which means to publicize the miracle. So this concept that not only are we meant to hold it within ourselves, but to let people know about this, to let people know about the concept of miracles and that they can see miracles in their own lives and that they should know that God has an active presence within our lives and that they should understand that one of the ways that to dealing with darkness is by lighting a small candle and eventually the darkness will dissipate. And so that idea, certainly over the past 50 years, has become something that people have gravitated to and identified to more and more.
So you mentioned two things. You mentioned biblical holidays and then rabbinic holidays. What's the differentiation between those and what are some of the other holidays that would fit into each of those categories?
Okay. The Bible mentions five holidays. It mentions the three regalim, which means the 3 days that the Jews were obligated to go to Jerusalem. And those are the holidays of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, Pesach, which is Passover, and Shavuot, which is the holiday of the giving of the Torah. I don't remember what the Pentecost, I believe it is. My Greek is a little bit weak.
That's okay. You've been in Seattle for a while. So.
Exactly. Beyond those two, the Torah also mentions the fast of Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, the new year. So those are the five biblical holidays. And on those holidays, we're told not to work with all of the ramifications of do not work. There are specific rules. and with specific things that we need to do on those days. On the Feast of Tabernacles, for example, we eat in a sukkah, which is a hut covered by some type of leafy greens. We take four species, we put them together, and there are a number of things that we need to do over that day. The same thing with regards to Passover, we eat matzah. And Rosh Hashanah, we blow the shofar. Yom Kippur, we fast. So there's specific things that we're beholden to on those days. On the other hand, over time, there were two major miracles that happened to the entire Jewish people. Those being the Feast of Esther. Mm-hmm. So the whole story recounted in the Book of Esther, and that's known as Purim. And the story of Hanukkah as well, being the two major holidays that occurred to the entire Jewish people, which would have a serious impact on the Jewish people from an exile perspective, from a perspective of how do we deal with cultures that are trying to impose their will upon us? How do we react? Both of them were extremely, extremely important in teaching the Jewish people for the future how to deal with 2,000 years of exile, how to deal with 2,000 years of being disconnected from a temple and like those significant ritual elements and cultural elements that led Judaism for all those years.
So how does Hanukkah get celebrated? Is it celebrated from the get-go, right after the olive oil was lit in the temple and the rededication, or was this something that emerged later? What's the history of the holiday itself?
That's a really fascinating question. The next year, they celebrated it, and they said, okay, this is going to become a holiday. Over time, it developed. The first year, they said, let's light a candle, any candle, in order to celebrate the miracle. That eventually became a disagreement between two schools of thought, and this is all recounted in the Talmud in Tractate Shabbat. The two schools of thought said that the best ways to be able to celebrate it would be to have eight candles for the 8 days of miracles. One school of thought said you start with eight, and the second night you light seven, the third night you light six, etc. The other school of thought said you start with one, go to two, go to three, etc. And it eventually became the worldwide Jewish custom to start with one and go upwards. And the reason why is because we always go upwards in holiness. We don't go down. The reason for the group that said you start with eight and go down is because of there we're looking at the potential. On the first night, there's 8 days of potential miracles, 7 days of potential miracles, etc. But the average person doesn't deal with potential. They deal with practical. What do I have right now? Right now, we found the one cruse of oil. That itself is a miracle. Let's celebrate. The second day, all right, we've had 1 day of miraculous oil, etc. And so mm-hmm. we go onwards. Practical is always far more impactful than the potential.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and that's when it starts off. And you know, I've read or heard a lot of things that Hanukkah has become more popularized in Christian cultures because you have Christmas at the same time of season, roughly within the same month or so. How has the diaspora into Christianized countries affected the celebration of Hanukkah?
Well, back in the day, there was the concept of giving your children Hanukkah Geld. Geld in Yiddish and German means money. And the idea was to reward them for how they were doing academically. And the word Hanukkah has a relation to the word chinuch, which means education. And that's the same kind of concept of as dedication, where you're dedicating your children to a life of something or other. And so therefore, the custom was to give your children a little monetary reward for how they were doing in school. In the United States, it became giving presents because that was the culture with regards to Christmas, and I believe that that was the crossover. And so What's interesting is that, and most Jews don't know this, and I love telling students about this and telling them to go back to their parents, that every holiday we're told to give our family presents. It's one of these kind of funny things in the Talmud where you look back and say things don't change. It says, what should you give your family? It says, wives should give their husbands meat and wine. Husbands should give their wives good clothes and buy your kids toys and sweets. Things haven't changed in 2,000 years.
Yeah.
And so that's how we celebrate every holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Hanukkah is no different. So you want to give your kids presents, there's no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah, so a little cultural observations here. Being that I'm at a university and our university is on a quarter system and tends to start in late September, early October, we oftentimes run across Yom Kippur and the High Holy Days. And so we usually get a memo saying, be respectful of the High Holy Days of your Jewish students. And so I'm aware of those days. But I think if you go out in other parts of the country and you ask people, what's the number one holiday for Jews in America here? They would say Hanukkah. And is that different? You lived in Crimea, you lived in Israel and many other places. Is the celebration of Hanukkah different in those different places, especially Israel, right, where, Christmas probably is not going to be a real big thing there?
Oh, let me tell you this. You can see Nazareth from about 5 miles away around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm. Really lit up, huh?
It's really, really, really lit up. But Hanukkah is really it's become a holiday of Jewish pride.
Mm-hmm.
So they have massive menorah lightings across the world. Starting in 1974, the Rebbe began a campaign to bring menorahs to the world and to start lighting them in public places that people can see and appreciate this concept of lighting up the darkness. I remember as a kid, and this is probably 1990 or something like that, they made a satellite hookup with all of the countries across the world. And so they had a menorah lighting in Australia, a menorah lighting in Hong Kong, and in the central Chabad headquarters in New York and Jerusalem. And possibly the most meaningful one was a menorah lighting in the Kremlin. And that was really, really, really powerful, even as a kid. Just the concept of being able to light a menorah in the Kremlin itself at Red Square, and not the UW's Red Square. Mm-hmm. We light it at Red Square, but that's not quite as powerful as that one. And that continues even to this day. But that concept certainly has gone very, very far. I think also people find it very, very easy to connect to. All you're doing is lighting a candle. Some of the other holidays are more technical. They're more difficult for the secular person to do. To build a sukkah seems to be a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
Eating matzah or not even eating leavened foods for 8 days sometimes is a little bit difficult, although people do try to do it. But Hanukkah is just something that even somebody who's extremely secular can identify with and can do the tradition very properly.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine the lighting of the menorah in the Kremlin. As you mentioned, it sent a little shiver up my spine. I mean, you're talking about this in the early 90s, and this is just after the Berlin Wall had fallen, and 2 years later the Soviet Union crumbles. I mean, for me, that was a very impactful time in my life just to be watching that, and I can imagine for the Jewish community it's even more so given the important role that Jewish refuseniks played, the importance of religious liberty, religious freedom that you had mentioned earlier about the celebration of Hanukkah. That just must have been just absolutely fascinating to watch.
Absolutely, and especially because of the fact that in the Chabad movement had an underground, they were running the refusnik program that was actually continuous up to the actual fall of communism, and that's the reason why Chabad is so strong in the former Soviet Union today, because the Russians knew that Russian Jewry knew that they could depend on Chabad. Chabad had always been there. Of course, the origin of Chabad is in Russia itself. But because of the fact that there was a very strong underground that was and you know, we grew up with these stories about Jews who both lived and died, were killed by Stalin and such. You know, one of my favorite books even to today is a book called Sabota, My 20 Years in the Soviet Gulag, which is an incredible, incredible story about a Jew who managed to stay observant through 20 years of separation from his family, and separation from the entire Jewish community, and to be able to maintain his Judaism, to light the menorah, to be able to manage to get matzah or whatever it is under Stalin, under Khrushchev, under these people who are just really, really the lowest of the low, is really something that was incredibly, incredibly impactful on me and continues to be.
This brings up an interesting question. I was hoping to touch on this a little bit later, but as I hear you talk now, this raises a very interesting issue. One would imagine that the salience of Hanukkah in Russia would be very visceral. It's only 20, 30 years ago that we were underground and fighting for our religious freedom. The story of the Jewish refuseniks becomes very important. So that has a lot of meaning. In the United States, on the other hand, is there a sense that a lot of the meaning has been lost? I mean, we're in a culture that everything, you know, is pretty good. We got consumer culture. People complain about that in terms of Christmas. Do you sense that there's – that different cultures place different emphasis or meaning on Hanukkah?
I would somewhat agree with you that I think there's a lack of perception of depth in our culture as a whole. We live in a world of memes and sound bites, text messaging. So context is very limited, and people are not taught to think through an idea all the way. So I certainly would agree with that. I do believe it can be taught. And so therefore, from my perspective as a rabbi, I try to teach people to think about that and appreciate the freedoms that we have. Certainly with Veterans Day just 2 days ago, that's certainly a subject I believe that should be on all of our minds. And something about freedom is not necessarily free. We need to protect that freedom. We need to recognize how unique it is in the history of the world, freedom is. And this is not, the United States of America is not just another country. Democracy is not just another theory. This is something that's very, very, very unique and can be very fragile. So I certainly do agree that it should be appreciated and celebrated and protected. And you know, I believe that Hanukkah has a very strong message with regards to that we appreciate deeply the ability to be able to serve God as we are, and the concepts of religious freedom, and to respect everybody else's opinions, and certainly, even though obviously we do disagree, but disagreements don't mean disrespect.
Yeah, this conversation is so wonderful in that respect. When you're talking about the religious freedom aspect of Hanukkah, it really never occurred to me. I know vaguely the story of it, and so it's always good to hear, you know, learn a little bit more about this. But the religious freedom aspect, I think, is really cool, and I'm going to be looking at Hanukkah in a lot different light, so to speak. You know, to use a little bit of analogy here. And speaking of that, I want to move next to some of the traditions associated with Hanukkah. We've already talked a little bit about the lighting of the menorah and the eight candles. Tell us about some of these traditions. Actually, I have a question about the lighting of the menorah, and you went through the controversy. Do we start with eight and go down to one, or do we go to one and start with eight? But is there a separate lesson that comes with each of the candles? And the reason I ask this is because I've been associated with the Boy Scouts of America, and they do a lighting of 12 candles to emphasize the points of the Scout Law. And so each candle that's lit has a different message. Is there something similar that goes on during the holiday of Hanukkah?
Well, it's an interesting question. The previous Rebbe of Chabad, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, who himself had been arrested and actually condemned to death by the Soviets in 1927, I believe it was, had a beautiful, beautiful saying. He used to say, listen to what the candles are telling you. And I try personally to send out a text message or a little Twitter line of different ideas that we can learn from Hanukkah every single night of the eight nights. So while there certainly is the concept that we discussed before of going upwards in holiness, and while one candle was good last night, it's not good enough for tonight, we got to add, we got to kind of keep going. The specific meaning that you find in each candle needs to be really the way you personally look at it. It's really not given a specific meaning. Rather, you look at it in your own life. How can I relate to this? This is the concept of internalizing an idea. And I think that's a very powerful way of looking at a holiday, that there's the general meaning to something, and then there's how I apply it in my own life. Personally, oftentimes I reflect back to the way things happened, you know, whether you're talking about in the Holocaust, you had Jews who wanted to celebrate Hanukkah, and so they would divvy out their margarine so that they could melt the margarine into oil for Hanukkah, even though they had I think it was something like, I can't remember how many grams of bread they were allowed every single day, but they would put margarine aside, and, you know, the entire group, and line it under the Nazis' noses. They would take their spoons. There's a beautiful story about a barrack somewhere. I don't remember which concentration camp it was, but they took their spoons and they bent them into menorah. Other people took their potatoes and peeled out the potatoes and made them into the menorah. So you think about that and what they went through, and you reflect on how they managed to get through those things. And suddenly our own problems kind of dissipate when you think about that. But you also think about the fact that we've maintained these traditions throughout all that. So it really depends on you personally. What do you know about your world? How do you know about how God interacts in your world? You know, what miracles have you experienced in your own world? What things have you looked at in life that you haven't realized, actually, this was a miracle, I just never thought about it before? Those kinds of things.
Well, that's real cool lessons to be learning during this period of time. What other traditions are there associated with the holiday of Hanukkah? Are there special prayers, special songs?
There are many special prayers and special songs, and it depends on which tradition you come from in terms of the tunes, in terms of the lyrics. Many different well-known songs, even in English, many people sing specific songs. And we certainly add in prayers during those days, specifically the Hallel prayers, which are the group of psalms from, I believe it is chapter 114 through 118. We say every single day of Hanukkah. And besides that, we eat foods fried in oil. Mm-hmm. It's a cardiologist's favorite holiday.
Well, they've backed off on the fried food stuff. Yeah, now. So it's okay. It's really good. So what you've known for 2,000 years, it's all good.
All right.
And I'm all down with the fried food stuff. So yeah, actually, what are some of the foods we associate with Hanukkah?
So in Ashkenazic culture, specifically fried potatoes. So potato latkes are like potato pancakes. That's the most famous. In Israel, and certainly has come over to the United States, is donuts, jelly donuts. And those are absolutely delicious and slightly deadly, I think, maybe, if you eat too many of them.
Yeah, it's the carbs. You got to watch the carbs.
It's that, right? That's what it is.
Fried. Yeah.
And also we eat dairy foods out of appreciation for a woman by the name of Judith, who killed a Greek general by the name of Holofernes. He was a Greek general, and she was a widow, a very attractive widow. And she kind of introduced herself to him as a potential spy. She said, "Listen, you know, I'm happy to get to know you and such." And over times, she managed to gain his trust and then eventually fed him a proper meal of cheeses and, you know, warm milk and such. And he fell asleep after this after gorging himself on this. And she took his sword and off with his head and told the Maccabees, "Oh, by the way, I suggest this would be a really, really good time to attack."
Wow, yeah.
So things like that. So out of appreciation to her and the miracle that happened with her, that he ended up trusting her. We certainly eat dairy foods as well.
How many people know that tradition? That seems fairly obscure reference.
I don't know. There's certainly the numbers. You know, just it's always nice to add something in terms of food or culinary experience, because the fact of the matter is that as human beings, we relate to things not just in terms of the spiritual. Sometimes the spiritual is much more difficult to relate to. Mm-hmm. But when you attach it to something that has a clear relativity to your stomach, to your taste buds, mm-hmm. and then you remember the story a little bit better and you connect to it and you enjoy it so much more.
Are Hamantaschen also?
That's Purim.
Oh, that's Purim. Okay, that's
we
right.
can talk
okay.
about that in a couple months.
We should. Yeah, we should, because I love those.
Actually. Absolutely.
I love Jewish food, so it's really good.
There's a game as well that we play. It's called the game of dreidel.
Yes, that was I want to ask about. What is the dreidel thing about?
So the story is that among the things that the Jews were not allowed to do is teach your children. And of course, the Soviets were legendary about this as well. They said, if you're older, you're an old man, you want to study the Torah, that's fine. But teaching your children, that's an absolute no-no. And many, many, many rabbis were sent to prison or put to death because of the fact that they were teaching. That's critical, absolutely critical. If the Jews have taught one thing to the world, it's the importance of education and the importance of teaching children how to think, critical thinking, not just thinking, not just repeating information, but critical thinking. And so the Jews used to go out to the caves, all scattered through the hillsides of the Galilee, teach the children, and then when the Greek patrols would come through, the kids would pull out these toys and basically just be playing, oh, I don't know, we're just playing with this top. Mm-hmm. And so in recognition of that element of the story, we have a four-sided top. Each has one Hebrew letter. Nun, Gimel, He, and Shin. In Israel, there's a Pe at the end, and that stands for the words Nes Gadol Hayasham, which means there was a great miracle that happened there, or the Hebrew is a great miracle happened here. And when you land the different letters, you either have to put into the pot or take out of the pot. And typically nowadays we do it with chocolate coins, and the kids are on a sugar high for the next month.
Well, you got the fried food to bring them down to, I guess. I don't know. So
good point.
Yeah, this is a very delicious holiday, I have to say. Speaking of food, we were just talking about food a moment ago and talking about how different Jewish traditions celebrate the holiday. I want to come back to that. Other than food, are there different ways that the different Jewish branches celebrate this? You have Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews, but you also have the ultra-Orthodox, Orthodox, Reform traditions out there as well. Are there any differences that have emerged, or is it a very unifying holiday?
I would say that Hanukkah is a very unifying holiday. It seems to be that everybody celebrates it very, very similarly. The menorahs themselves, they can be made out of anything. When I was in rabbinical seminary and people didn't have their menorahs, it was always an interesting thing to see what guys would make their menorahs out of, whether it was beer bottles or all sorts of interesting things that they would pull together. But you can make your menorah out of absolutely anything. And you could really celebrate with the foods in whatever ways your culture focuses on. So potatoes are obviously a European food. Mm-hmm. And so therefore it was latkes. And in the Arabic worlds, there were other things that they would fry in oil. So it was very, very similar things. And whereas the songs might be slightly different, but that's really not the critical element of the holiday. The critical element is the lighting of the menorah every single night, and that, I would say, really extends across all the cultures.
I want to finish up here with some thoughts of the celebration of Hanukkah here in the United States, and this takes me back 2,000 years to the original story wherein you have the Greeks trying to assimilate Jews. Right. And, Jews are a minority here in the United States, and you can imagine all the cultural pressures that are around for assimilation all the time. And we've talked to a few other folks on this podcast before about those pressures. How do you, as a rabbi, deal with this? You're here in Seattle. You're on a campus, University of Washington, working with young people. It's a time where oftentimes young people lose their faith. They go off to this new environment. They're away from their home for a while, and they just kind of drift away. How do you use Hanukkah to help reach out to young Jews?
That's an excellent, excellent question, and it's certainly something that we struggle with. I think most cultures nowadays recognize the dangers of assimilation, whereas 50, 60 years ago there was a desire to assimilate, whereas nowadays there's much more focus on, okay, how can we maintain our unique identity? Hanukkah is the easiest holiday for people to identify with. The concept of lighting a candle is not difficult at all. The ability to light it in your home is something that gives you the ability to be able to do it yourself. You're not dependent on a rabbi. You're not dependent on a synagogue. You're not dependent on anything like that. So therefore, in terms of Hanukkah, it's absolutely my favorite holiday to celebrate with the students because they really identify with it a lot. They also do see Christmas all around themselves, and they do want to celebrate something for themselves. Mm-hmm. They want what is my own culture. At the same time, at the University of Washington, the students that we're dealing with are typically assimilated in any case. My own family, my father's family, as well as my mother's family, are really not observant Jews at all. And so therefore, I see the disconnect that happens from one generation to the next in a very, very visceral way. And so therefore, it's so much more meaningful to try to bring some element of our culture to students. Mm-hmm. And from a Jewish perspective, I think it's very, very interesting because of the fact that they feel modern. Mm-hmm. And so when you're trying to connect them to an ancient family, the concept is a lot.
It's hard, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot to handle. They can't really place themselves into an ancient race, you know, an ancient culture going back 2,000, 2,500 years ago, 3,000 and even more. And it really just takes time. And one of the key ideas is connect one small piece at a time. You don't need to jump into everything. I'd say whole hog, but then I'd probably get in trouble.
Yeah.
but rather to do one small thing, one small step for your Judaism so that you can identify with your past and that you have some kind of relativity to it in your daily life. And we just try to encourage people, take one thing. Once you're comfortable with that one thing, all right, take one more thing. And that way, wherever your Jewish journey takes you, you know who you are. Because in a world that's as confused as our world is, and it truly is a confused world, there's nothing more important for young adults nowadays to know who they are and what they're doing in this world. And for a Jew, it means that you can be a Jew in whatever culture you're at, but the way to deal with it best is to have something that grounds you to that world.
What a wonderful holiday in that it allows you to connect to your historical traditions and celebrate religious freedom and pluralism at the same time. What a wonderful, wonderful holiday. And we wish you the best during that holiday season. My guest today has been Rabbi Eli Estrin. Eli, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.